This is Radio Orbit, exploring the secrets of everything on KOPN 89.5 FM, Columbia.
Good morning to you, or good day to you, wherever you might be as you listen to this program. This is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN 89.5 FM, Columbia. And we're Mid-Missouri's source for in-depth news, diverse talk, music of the world. It's more than radio. It's your community radio, listener-sponsored community radio, your imagination station, KOPN 89.5 FM, and you're listening to it right now. Radio Orbit, we come to you every Monday night from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning, talking about the strange and the mysterious and the weird and wacky and all kinds of interesting things every week. And tonight, no different. I'm really excited about the show tonight. My guest is Jay Widener, the author of A Monument to the End of Time, among other things. And we'll get into a little bit more about what Jay is about in a little while. But first, quick thanks to Debbie. Wonderful show again, as always, on Free Range Radio Theater. Jason and Kelvin before that. Monday night's always cool on the Mighty Fine 89, as my favorite professor puts it. All right, thanks for the emails. Thanks to everybody listening over the web. We're going to do space weather in just a bit here, but first I want to give out some contact information, and we'll talk about upcoming guests, what's going on over the next couple of weeks here. The email address, orbitradio@aol.com, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O at AOL.com. If you have questions, comments, concerns, ideas for future programs, any of that stuff, feel free to send me an email at orbitradio@AOL.com. I appreciate all the stuff that you guys send and take it to heart and try to incorporate that stuff into future programs. So don't be afraid to send a note if you got something to say, all right? Okay, also the website, www.radioorbit.com. That's RadioRBIT.com. Just one O in the middle there. And the phone number here at the station in the studio is 573-874-5676. If you want to give me a buzz in between when we're taking a break, you're more than welcome to do that. And if you're outside of the 573 area code, it's 1-800-895-5676. That's 1-800-895-KOPN. All right? Okay. Tonight, as I said, Jay Widener, he is an historian, an expert on ancient history, ancient mystery, Gnosticism, alchemy. And in particular tonight, we're going to be talking about the Great Cyclic Cross of Ondi. And Ondi, or Henday, as you may hear us refer to it throughout the night, is a small town in the south of France where a stone monument, a cross, was erected some 300 or 400 years ago. And up until Jay rolled around, other than a few initiates that knew that there was something special about this particular monument, Jay has sort of brought it out into the light of day. And we're going to be talking about his research and what he thinks the cross means and how it ties into some of the things that I mentioned before, Gnosticism, alchemy, and quite frankly, the end of time, as we know it at least. So that's coming up tonight, so stick around. It's going to be a great show. Jay will be on the air here live from Seattle, home of Kent Stedman, actually. I'm trying to hook Kent and Jay up because they're both wonderful researchers with a lot of knowledge, and I'm sure that they could really help each other in their own way. At any rate, in about 45 minutes, Jay Widener live from Seattle, okay? All right, next week, Michael Horn. I've mentioned this before, but the Billy Meyer story, if you're interested in UFOs and extraterrestrials and the like, the Billy Meyer story is sort of the quintessential UFO story that's been around since the early days, back in the late 60s and the early 70s, and continuing now to this day, and still a controversial subject and a topic that still brings about great debate in scientific and the so-called UFO community. So Michael Horn will be on next week talking with us about Billy Meyer and the Billy Meyer story. Michael Horn has been involved in the Billy Meyer story for about 25 of those years, so a good chunk of the story he's familiar with personally through experience, and that's what we like to talk about in this program, people that have experience with things. So at any rate, that should be a fun program next weekend. Michael Horn talking about Billy Meyer, okay? July 25th, the following weekend. Now, I had planned on doing this party for the one-year anniversary of the show, and I'm still going to do it, but I had to schedule a guest for the 25th because it was the only night that I could get him. And his name is Nassim Haramein, and I've been trying to get Nassim on the show for a while, and we've had difficulty with scheduling, and this was an opportunity to just jump on it, and so I did. And Nassim's going to be on the show on the 25th of July, and the reason that I'm so excited about this is because first of all, he runs a website called The Resonance Project, and he is, however, a theoretical physicist, and along with another physicist whose name is Dr. Rauscher, they have just announced the acceptance for publication of Nassim and Dr. Rauscher's paper called The Origin of Spin, A Consideration of Torque and Coriolis Forces in Einstein Field Equations and Grand Unification Theory. And that may sound like a mouthful, but the bottom line is it's going to be in the peer-reviewed Noetic Journal, and it's a groundbreaking paper that proposes a solution to the long-sought quest for a unified field theory. And it means a tremendous amount, possibly, to our understanding of physics as we know it. and it could change a whole lot of things, the implications of what Dr. Rauscher and Nassim have brought to light here. So anyway, Nassim Haramein will be live with us from Hawaii on the 25th of July, and we're going to do our little party on the following week, August 1st. So hopefully this is enough notice for anybody out there who was hoping to come down here to the station on the 25th. Well, hopefully you can still make it the following week. It'll be August 1st, a Monday. We're going to have live music down here. We'll sort of keep the microphone open. I'll be recording the whole thing, and I'm going to let people actually put the headphones on and play some music, and you can talk for a few minutes or whatever, and we'll make comments about the show, and we'll just have a good time. So anyway, that's all coming up in just a few weeks. So August 1st, mark that on your calendar, 11 o'clock, right down here at 915 East Broadway, downtown Columbia. We're going to do it up, all right? The following week, probably Nick Cook. Most likely Nick Cook. And if you remember, Nick has been on the program before. He is a the former editor of Jane's Defense Weekly. For 15 years, he was the aviation and aerospace editor for Jane's, and he is very well-versed in areas of propulsion and aerospace technology. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Hunt for Zero Point, and The Hunt for Zero Point was about the trail of anti-gravity technology that Nick has been following for the last 10 or 12 years now, and he has a follow-up book to that coming up, and he's a tremendous guy, spends most of his time in London, is an Englishman, but has traveled around the world sort of chasing down these this research about anti-gravity and other exotic energy and propulsion technologies. So we're going to have Nick on the air. It's not really tied down yet, but it'll either be August 8th or the 22nd. I think I'm going to be out of town on the 15th. So, at any rate, some good stuff coming up. John Lash still coming up in the next few months, and I got a whole list of other people that I'm working on, and just a matter of timing and scheduling. And of course, Alex Gray and his wife Allison, two of the most influential spiritual artists of our time and recognized as such, will be live from New York City. Coming up on September 5th, and that is going to be a show that, boy, I sure hope, I hope anybody out there who's interested in any of the topics that we talk about on this show, listen to the show with Alex Gray, because he is tremendously articulate. He is a brilliant, brilliant guy. His wife is an amazing woman. Allison is something else, and they will both astound you, not only with their visual art, but with their words as well, and I really look forward to talking with them in just a few weeks. Okay, so that's what's going on, and we'll come back and do space weather in a few minutes. There's so many things to talk about. Unfortunately, we can't get to them all. There have been tremendous earthquake activity all around the Ring of Fire. The bombings in London, of course, which I have a few things to say about. I don't usually talk about political stuff, but just to get this out of the way, I just found it interesting that with regard to the London bombings that took place a couple of days ago, there are two or three particular stories that I'm just going to mention real fast. The first one is that there were quote-unquote exercises being carried out that morning at the same exact time for the exact same scenario that actually took place that was being... The exercises were being undertaken by a private security firm that's involved with the intelligence community there in the United Kingdom. And that was something that is eerily reminiscent of what took place on September 11th, 2001 in this country. For those of you who are not familiar, there were NRO and CIA operations underway on the morning of 9/11 that mirrored identically the events that took place, and the same thing happened in London. There were exercises that were going on that morning. It was a very quietly released story, but came out just yesterday. The other thing is the cameras on the bus weren't working. The bus that exploded had four closed caption cameras. And in another relatively obscure story, we find out that those cameras were not operating on the morning of the 7th. Again, eerily familiar with the camera situation in New York City, actually at the Pentagon, on September 11th. The third story is that Tony Blair already yesterday has rejected requests by conservative members of his parliament to open up an investigation, a government investigation into the bombings. So those three stories, and there are some other ones that are interesting, but those three alone all mirror exactly what happened here on September 11th, 2001, and I think that that is of note. Take it as you like it. Make of it what you will. Okay? Unprecedented warming in Canada. Environmental catastrophe everywhere right now. UFOs flying wild over South America. Hurricane geometry again. The eye of Hurricane Dennis. We observed and saved the satellite imagery of Hurricane Dennis as it approached Florida and the Gulf Coast a couple of days ago. And again, as we saw with Isabel and with Charlie and with Jean, we saw pentagonal geometry showing up inside the eye of a 150-mile-an-hour vortex. All right? And this is an intelligence test, but those sort of angular geometries do not show up in nature, particularly in spinning vortices. So if you're interested in that, you can go down to cyberspaceorbit.com. Kent, of course, always has that imagery up and pictures worth a thousand words. So jump onto my site if you like at radioorbit.com, and you can always get over to Kent's from my site, but you can always get to him directly through www.cyberspaceorbit.com. Okay? All right, so obviously lots and lots going on. The shuttle launch coming up on Wednesday. A new feature from Google called Google Earth, where you can actually see satellite photos of pretty much anywhere on the planet and then zoom right in on local areas, even look at the top of your own house, perhaps. And anyway, lots and lots in the news, but we don't have a whole lot of time to talk. Play a little bit of music and come back, do space weather, a couple stories, and then we'll get things going at the top of the hour with Jay Widener, the author of A Monument to the End of Time, Fulcanelli, Alchemy, and the Great Cross of Andai. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of this stuff tonight. Jay is a tremendously intelligent guy. Lots and lots of cool stuff to talk about. We're going to be talking about the cathedrals, the Gothic cathedrals of Europe. We're going to be talking about alchemy, early Christian traditions of Gnostic Christianity, some of the secret societies that evolved out of French occultism during those times, and are alive today. Anyway, lots of stuff to talk about with Jay, and so stick around. That's all coming up. In the meantime, here's a little bit of music to get things going, and kick back, relax. We're going to have a good time tonight, and I've got some interesting stories to talk about before we get to Jay. All right, so back in a few minutes. This is Sun Kill Moon, and you're also listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Mike Hagan. I'll be back in just a few to chat with you some more. We'll be right back. All right. This is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN, Columbia, 89.5 FM. That was Sun Kill Moon, one of my favorite new bands. Hope you guys like that. Okay. Space weather. Aurora watch. Keep your eyes out to the north. Maybe not making it all the way down here to Missouri, but if you're listening to this over the web and if you're in the northern latitudes, the next few days should be pretty amazing up there. There was a big coronal mass ejection that was tossed out into space by the sun from a big giant sunspot area that we talked about last week, or a couple weeks ago at least, number 786, and that happened just yesterday on the 10th. There's actually a really cool movie of it if you want to watch it and see it actually happen in real time. Well, now it's not real time, but you can see it happen as it happened if you go over to spaceweather.com, and they record all that stuff, and you can watch it with your own eyes, and it's pretty impressive, actually. So at any rate, a big old flare and accompanying coronal mass ejection on the 10th is now on its way to planet Earth, and if you're up there in the high latitudes and you're a sky watcher, keep your eyes up and alert for auroras over the next couple of nights, tonight, tomorrow, and probably even on the 13th, okay? So the sun continues to be tremendously active, even though we are told that we are supposed to be in solar minimum. And, of course, solar minimum, it's really been interesting because solar maximum was supposed to occur right around the year 2000, the midpoint of 2000 into 2001. It's an 11-year cycle, plus or minus, this solar cycle that they talk about. At any rate, halfway through the cycle is what we call solar minimum, and we're now about halfway through the cycle. And at maximum, which was back again, like I say, in mid-2000, the level of activity, relatively speaking, was not much higher than it is today. And for the last 5 years, it has remained very active. And in fact, it doesn't even look like there was a peak in 2000 or 2001. If anything, the peak to me looks like it was in October of 2003. At any rate, the sun has been pretty unpredictable. And again, over the last few days, showing us that solar minimum is, well, I guess it's something to talk about, but it certainly doesn't appear in reality, in observation, that that's where we are right now. So we'll keep our eye on the sun, as we always do, and talk about it again next week, and I'll let you know if anything interesting happens between now and then, okay? All right. If you go outside in the morning, and if you have over the last few days, if you get up early, just before sunrise, or even right around sunrise, it's best if it's before sunrise, but Mars will be easily viewable with the unaided eye. Mars will it look like a bright star. It'll have sort of a red tinge to it. But if you look to the east around sunrise, you'll be able to see Mars very, very brightly in the low sky, and that polar cap of Mars is now angled to the sun in such a way that it's really reflecting a lot of light. And so it's very bright right now in the mornings. And if you have a small telescope even, and you take a look at Mars over the next few days in the morning, you'll get a great view of that planet. Okay? As far as near-Earth asteroids, there's nothing getting close to us that we're aware of. As always, there are rocks flying around that we're not aware of. And those are the ones that there's no reason to talk about them because you don't know where they are. But as far as the ones that we know about, nothing to worry about, okay? So don't lose any sleep over an asteroid hitting the planet. And, well, what time is it? It's 11:30. I'm going to call Jay in just a few minutes here, but let me read a couple stories, I guess. We'll do that, and we'll put on some music, get Jay on the phone, and then we'll do a little setup and bring him on at the top of the hour, okay? All right, here is a great story that just really caught my eye. It's short and sweet, but it's sort of a an appropriate story for the way that I see politics and pop culture in general right now in our country in particular. Of course, it's the only one that I'm really familiar with right now. I haven't been out of the country for a few years, so I can only tell you what I observe in this country. But this story really stuck to me. And here it is. This is from Istanbul, Turkey. It says, hundreds of sheep follow leader off cliff. This is from Reuters, from this morning at 9:11 a.m. Hundreds of sheep followed their leader off a cliff in eastern Turkey, plunging to their deaths this week while shepherds looked on in dismay. 400 sheep fell 15 yards to their deaths in a ravine in Van province near Iran, but broke the fall of another 1,100 animals who survived, the newspaper reports said Friday. Shepherds from Ikizir village neglected the flock while eating breakfast, leaving the sheep to roam free, the Daily News said. The loss to local farmers was estimated at 100,000 new lira. That's about $74,000. So, at any rate, a bunch of sheep followed the head sheep off a cliff. All right? So, extend the metaphor. All right, here's one more story that I'll mention before we play a little music here, and I'll get Jay on the phone. This is a story about Ray Kurzweil, and if you remember, his partner, Terry Grossman, Dr. Terry Grossman, was on the program just a few weeks ago. Actually, a couple months ago now, I guess. Time flies. But anyway, Dr. Terry Grossman was on Orbit, and we talked about his book with Ray called Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. And they're in the news again here recently in a story that was picked up all around the world. And this particular version is from The Guardian London, from the 8th of July, last Friday. And I'll read a little bit of it for you here, and we'll talk a little bit about it afterwards. But most people know Ray Kurzweil as an information technology wizard. Not only did he invent the CCD flatbed scanner, print-to-speech software for the blind, and OmniFont optical character recognition, but he also created the first commercially marketed large vocabulary speech recognition software. As if that wasn't enough, he's also known for his IT predictions. MIT's Marvin Minsky described Kurzweil as a leading futurist of our time. But his latest book is about health and longevity. Kurzweil co-authored Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, with Terry Grossman, founder and medical director of the Frontier Medical Institute, which is, of course, in Denver. And like I say, we talked to Terry just a couple months ago, but it's a longevity clinic that he put together back in the early 90s. All right, the book purports to make scientific case, to make the scientific case that immortality is within our grasp thanks to modern technology, and that it can be reached via three so-called bridges. And for those of you who missed the program, I'm going to give you it in a nutshell right here, all right? The first bridge relies on the latest medical research into aging and how to counteract the process of getting older with nutritionals. This means food and food supplementals, okay? The second bridge is about bioengineering and how we will soon be able to grow a new heart in the body, or be vaccinated, for example, against diseases such as cancer. The third bridge is about the benefits of technology such as nanotechnology, things like nanobots, strong artificial intelligence, and full immersion virtual reality of the kind experienced in the Hollywood movie The Matrix. Health and technology, it turns out, have been two passions of Ray Kurzweil for some time. At the age of 35, he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and found that the necessary insulin injections made him gain weight and made his health problems worse. Being a restless inventor, Kurzweil wasn't about to sit around and let the condition get the better of him. I read all the scientific literature that came up and came up with my own approach, he says. I've been free of any indication of diabetes ever since. For the first time, we are actually understanding these diseases and aging processes as information processes, he says. When we cross the third bridge, nanobots will replace our digestive systems. We will dispense with our heart, and yeah, you guessed it, replace it with nanobots that shuttle oxygen and carbon dioxide around our bodies. In Ray Kurzweil's future, we will be able to upgrade our bodies over the internet, downloading new programs to make us fitter, stronger, and healthier. All right, so this is the sort of stuff that that Ray is talking about and that we talked about with Terry Grossman on the air just a couple months ago. But this stuff is real and it's coming, the caveat being we have to hold the planet together, and it may be out of our grasp to hold the planet together as we hear tonight as we talk to Jay Widener. But at any rate, very interesting things are happening, and it is very well worth it to keep your eyes and ears open about these things, because all of them are simply a matter of information, just as Ray has realized. And the information is out there, but it's not always readily available. Sometimes you have to search it out. It will not always come to you spoon-fed from the guys at CNN or Fox or MSNBC or ABC, CBS, NBC, any of them. Okay? All right, words of wisdom. And let's play a little bit more music here. We'll come back in just a few minutes. I got a couple more stories to set up the show tonight, but we'll have Jay Widener on the air in just about 20 minutes here. And we'll be talking about Fulcanelli, the enigmatic figure of Fulcanelli. Who was he? What did he do? And what did he know about this cross at Andai, France? And we'll be talking about alchemy and lots of other interesting things tonight. So stick around. In the meantime, a little bit more music, and we'll come back in just a few. This is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN 89.5 FM, and this is Dvachka.
Occupation, fool, because when you love, I will stand up. there watching as it bleeds. You try your best in the winter light, when it really should be summer night. Is it too late, baby? Too late now. Everything could have been alright. Is it been too long, yeah? Is it too long now? Is it too long for you to make the change? Gotta love yourself to make a better day. What's the matter, money rules the groove now. What we're doing here today won't make the bad life go away. You gotta grow the beard, find the doubt, and maybe you'll work something out. Hey. Is it too long, baby? Too long now, yeah. Too long for you to make the change. You gotta love yourself. Better day, better
Okay, World Party from Goodbye Jumbo. That's Is It Too Late? We heard Dvochka before that. And this is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. All right, a couple quick stories here, and then we'll get things going with Jay Widener at the top of the hour, author of A Monument to the End of Time, among other things. All right, and I've tried to find a couple stories floating around the news that might be sort of relevant to what we're going to be talking about tonight, and it's sort of an obscure topic, so it wasn't easy, but this is the best I've got for you. Actually, the second story that I'm going to read is quite relevant, actually. This first one is sort of maybe just as a historical piece. So, at any rate, this first story says, who's buried in Charles IV's tomb? And this is from the Prague Daily Monitor. July 11th, the royal tomb built by Czech king and emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles IV, sometime after 1350 for himself and his family, has disclosed some of its secrets, art historian Jana Marakova told journalists on Friday. It contains the remains of coffins, bones, and clothing of church dignitaries who were buried there since the 16th century. She said researchers explored the tomb with a video camera, which they inserted through a hole 4 centimeters wide. 4 centimeters, that's 2.5, that's about 1.5 inches wide. The preparations lasted 5 years, and the research through the probe only lasted 2 days, Marakova said. We did not know in what state the tomb would be in. We knew that there was a cavity, but we had no idea whether it was changed or backfilled. The tomb is in a good state. It confirmed the measurements and temperatures by our measurements, and they find not a single reason to open it. Research into St. Vitus Cathedral in March discovered 2 chambers, a western chamber measuring 2.5 by 6.2 meters and an eastern chamber roughly 3.8 by 4.7 meters. Both chambers were vaulted. In the eastern chamber, there are wooden coffins and which contain skeletons. In the eastern chamber, they also contain nameplates and other ornaments. The western chamber holds cases, but they were not able to confirm what was inside of those cases. At any rate, according to historians, Charles IV, who died in 1378, built the tomb after his 2 wives and son had died. At that time, Charles was planning the construction of the new cathedral on the site of the original Romanesque basilica. Czech monarchs were buried in the old tomb until the 16th century. In 1590, the remains were transferred to a new royal tomb, which was built to the west and now is accessible to visitors. So anyway, some of the cathedrals, and this is one of the not one of the older cathedrals, but cathedrals still yielding secrets and mysteries at the same time. And speaking of mysteries and secrets, the following story is something that is actually relevant to the conversation that Jay and I are going to be having in a few minutes here. So I'm going to read it pretty much in its entirety. And it simply says, Newton's alchemy manuscript found. And again, this is from The Guardian in London. Sir Isaac Newton, famous for his revolutionary work in mathematics, optics, gravity, and the laws of motion, had a secret hobby. A collection of his notes, thought to have been lost 70 years ago, reveal his passion for alchemy and fruitless attempts to turn lead into gold. Now, before I continue, I want you to take to heart the tone in which this is written, all right? Because it'll give you an idea of the way propaganda is used. At any rate, let me continue here. His handwritten notes, and I'll point out what I'm talking about when I finish reading this, okay? His handwritten notes commenting on the work of other famous 17th century alchemists and documenting his own attempts to manufacture precious metals were rediscovered in the vaults of the Royal Society and will go on display for the first time next week at its Summer Science Exhibition. Newton kept hidden his occasional interest in alchemy during his lifetime, in part because the making of gold or silver was a felony and had been since a law had passed by Henry IV in 1404. But throughout his career, he and other scientists of the time, many of whom were fellows of the society, carried out extensive research into alchemy. The text is written in English, but it is not easy to work out what Newton is actually saying. Alchemists were notorious for recording their methods and theories in symbolic language or code, so others could not understand it. One excerpt reads, "It is therefore no wonder that, in their advice, lay before us the rule of nature in obtaining the great secret both for medicine and transmutation. And if I may have the liberty of expression, give me leave to assert as my opinion that it is effectual in all the 3 kingdoms and from every species, may be produced when the modus is rightly understood. Only minerals produce minerals." John Young from the Newton Project said, "This is a hugely exciting find for Newton scholars and for historians of science in general. It provides vital evidence about the alchemical authors Newton was reading and the alchemical theories he was investigating in the last decades of the 17th century. The whereabouts of this document had been unknown since 1936, and it was a real thrill to see it preserved in the Royal Society's archives. All right, a wonderful story. And in fact, Sir Isaac Newton had over a million words, I think, written on alchemy. There was a larger story, actually, that came out about a year ago, and he was extensively involved and interested in the science of alchemy. Now, this is a man who is considered basically one of the fathers, at least, of modern physics, and he was a brilliant man. There's no question about it. So there are some questions here, and the first question is this. As I read in the first paragraph of this story, it says, a collection of his notes, thought to have been lost 70 years ago, reveal his passion for alchemy and fruitless attempts to turn lead into gold. The fact that they use that language, fruitless attempts, and then go on in the article to explain that they have no idea what he was even talking about. In other words, they make it clear that the alchemists wrote in code and that very few people understood what they were talking about. And they also make a point later in the article of what a brilliant scientist he was. So the question is, if one of the fathers of modern physics was deeply interested in this, in fact, probably more interested in it than he was in the other stuff that he was working on that he became famous for, why was that? Now, the other question that comes to mind really quickly here, it says, Newton kept hidden his occasional interest in alchemy during his lifetime, in part because the making of gold and silver was a felony and had been since a law was passed by Henry IV in 1404. If it's a felony to make gold or silver, why would you pass a law for something that wasn't physically capable of being done? In other words, it was obviously a concern of the elite of the day that people were going to make gold and silver and therefore probably tip over the apple cart, so to speak. But at any rate, lots of contradictions in this story in and of itself, but the bottom line was Sir Isaac Newton very interested in alchemy, and there was a good reason for him to be interested in alchemy. And as we're going to find out tonight, alchemy is a little bit more than what we were all taught in grade school and in high school. A little bit more than madmen in basements getting stoned off mercury vapors and fruitlessly trying to turn lead into gold. And when we come back in just a few minutes, we're going to find out just what the heck I'm talking about. All right, my guest in 2 or 3 minutes, Jay Widener, the author of A Monument to the End of Time, Fulcanelli Alchemy at the Great Cyclic Cross of Hendaye, or Hendaye, as I said earlier. We'll probably interchange those two words tonight. At any rate, wonderfully cool and exciting stuff coming up in just a few minutes, and we'll do it up, okay? One more piece of music. We'll be back with Jay Widener in just a few minutes. This is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia.
Rain, Latin angels falling down, like a mission and we're halfway there from some old dried up fried forgotten town. Why won't they let us be ourselves? With our potential we could toe the line and show the bastards up with our divine lies. All the past, hope for ransom, all this
Right, you are listening to Mike Hagan on Radio Orbit KOPN Columbia, and we're going to get right down to business here. My guest tonight, his name is Jay Widener, and he is an author, he's a filmmaker, he's a scholar on the Hermetic arts and the science of alchemy. He's authored a number of books, or co-authored a number of books, among them The Mysteries of the Great Cross of Ondi, Alchemy, and the End of Time, and also A Monument to the End of Time with Vincent Bridges that I mentioned earlier. Jay's also produced and directed some documentary films, among them The Secrets of Alchemy, The Great Cross and the End of Time, which I watched just a couple of nights ago, and we'll be pretty much covering some of the material that's in that DVD tonight, but just a fantastic piece of work. And he's also done some work, and as you'll find out tonight, Jay has done some work. And his research has included Dr. Paul LaViolette, who, of course, has been on the program here. And Dr. LaViolette's work ties in pretty deeply with the work that that Jay has done. So, anyway, Jay's also produced this particular video for Paul called Earth Under Fire. And interestingly, he's also done another video called Art Mind with Alex Gray, and of course Alex is going to be on the show here in early September, on September 5th. So again, all these lines sort of converging in really interesting ways lately. So Jay has a new book called Alchemical Cinema, A Search for the Spirit in Contemporary Filmmaking. That will be published this fall, I think. And he's written lots of articles for magazines and journals over the years. He's done some wonderful pieces. A great piece that I read a couple of years ago called Alchemical Kubrick, which talks about the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the symbology and some of the deeper meanings in that movie. He's done a similar piece of work with the Lord of the Rings series. And he wrote a real recent piece here called The Golden Age and the End of the World. So anyway, Jay's done a lot of different things over the years. Tonight we're going to be talking about alchemy and the Great Cross. And all of this stuff is available at his website at jaywidener.com. That's www.jaywidener.com, jaywiedner.com. And of course you can get right over there from my site. If you go over to radioorbit.com, you'll see all the links right up on the front page there, okay? All right, so without further ado, let's say hello. Jay Widener, thanks very much for being with us tonight on Orbit.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's a long time coming, and really pleased that we finally got things worked out here together. By the way, that was The Shadow of Seattle by Marcy Playground before Jay got on the air, and I want to make sure I mention that. So, all right. Well, look, Jay, there's lots to talk about. We've got 2 hours, and I know how quickly these things go. So let's give a little bit of background on yourself, as much as you'd like, and then I'd like to start the story in 1986 at the garage sale, because I think it's an amazingly synchronistic beginning that just continues throughout the whole story. So maybe give us a little bit about yourself, and then start in L.A. in 86, maybe.
Sure. I was living in Los Angeles in 1986. I was a young screenwriter trying to break into Hollywood at the time, and wrote some fairly horrible horror films and things. And would spend my weekends perusing around Los Angeles searching for books, because I was a book collector, and I still do have thousands of books.
Okay.
I found a garage sale where an older guy died, and he apparently had lived alone, and someone was selling his book collection. And the man, whoever he was an amazing person and had an amazing book collection. And I purchased a lot of books that day, around 20 books, of which I still own almost all of them. And for $1 a book, they're all hard copies, hardcovers. Some of the books ended up being worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars. I didn't know at the time that that was the case. I took them home and began reading through them. One of the first books that I read out of this stack of books was a strange, very strange book called Mystery of the Cathedrals by a man with the single name of Fulcanelli. I couldn't understand the book. I considered myself a pretty smart guy, and I had read James Joyce's Ulysses, and I understood quantum physics, and I was a journalist, written many articles, and here I was confronted with a book that Ani honestly could not understand. And this really vexed me and bothered me, so I began reading the book over and over. And the book, I thought, was about the art and architecture of Gothic cathedrals, hence its name, Mystery of the Cathedrals, but actually I found out quickly that the book had nothing hardly to do with art and architecture, but had to do with alchemy. And being a fairly reasonable guy, I knew that alchemy was BS and couldn't possibly be real outside of maybe being a precursor to modern-day chemistry. But as I read the book, I realized that this man with the single name of Fulcanelli was a man of incredibly profound intelligence. In fact, still to this day, I'm amazed by the erudition that this man possessed, the incredible logic and reasoning and quality of thought. And I still read the book. It sits by my bed, and I reread it about every 4 or 5 months. It's one of those odd books that's a different book every time you read it.
Right.
And one of the peculiar things that he does in the book is he italicizes certain words. Ends up there's probably about 700 or 800 words in the book that are italicized.
Okay.
And I began pursuing each meaning that he italicized. And what I found was later, much later, 15 years later, I realized that, of course, this book was meant to initiate the reader into a completely different way of thinking. And it transformed me, and in the end I realized that pretty much everything that I'd been taught in college and high school was wrong, and that there was a completely different world that existed around us, and that there were highly intelligent men and women who were alchemists, and they're still around with us today, and they have a knowledge that is so profound and so astonishing that it really permeates our society. It's just that we don't know it. For instance, NASA, the space agency, the founders of NASA were interested in alchemy. Carl Jung, one of the fathers of psychiatry, was interested in alchemy. Leonardo da Vinci, of course, with the Da Vinci Code, but really one of the greatest artists that ever lived, was interested in alchemy. And, of course, the father of modern physics, as you were talking about, Newton, also, it was his favorite subject.
Right,
Stanley Kubrick, J.R.R.
Right.
Tolkien, many, many artists and scientists and philosophers are deeply interested in alchemy. And so this book began my career in pursuing this odd science, which is really not a science that is about transforming lead into gold, although that may very well be able to be something that is true. But it's really something much more profound and deep. It's about how to transform the human into illuminated thought so that we can transform our own bodies into light, so to speak.
Huh.
And that is really the main secret of alchemy.
Okay, so in other words, this, as you say, the idea of the that we were taught, the madman in the basement, as I mentioned before, stoned on mercury, that's at least a way oversimplification.
Well, it's also a trap. It's a trap set by the alchemists themselves.
Ah.
If you're really a very greedy person, you really could never understand alchemy. So if you were trying to change lead into gold in your basement, and that's all you're really interested in, you're sort of automatically excluded from the alchemical circles. These people were called puffers.
Right.
They were people who didn't really understand alchemy, and so they would spend all of their time constantly melting lead and trying incantations and different formulas and chemicals and things to try to get the lead to change into gold, and it was like a fake out, so that you were, if you did pursue that you were automatically eliminated from the upper levels of alchemical schools and alchemical thought.
All right, okay.
It should also be said that Tolkienelli, as I found out later, was completely anonymous, and no one knew who he was. In fact, the precursor to the CIA, the OSS, actually spent 2 years, 1946 and 1947, running all around France trying to find the true identity of this odd man and his strange book, and they never did. And that struck me as very odd also.
Yeah.
Also, the main subject of my books on alchemy and Tolkienelli is the Cross of Hendaye, or Hendaye in French, and Hitler actually visited the Cross of Hendaye in 1940, right in the middle of World War II. So it's a much bigger subject than anyone really realizes, but it's a subject that is so obscure and difficult to comprehend for most people that it just has been forgotten. However, I consider one of my main tasks in this life is to make it accessible to people so they can understand that even us in the West have a very profound shamanic tradition that goes back thousands and thousands of years.
Well,
it's fine to go to Peru and take ayahuasca, or go to Siberia and consume mushrooms or something like that. It's encouraging and satisfying to know that even in Europe, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, there's a shamanic, mystical, spiritual tradition, and it's alchemy.
Right. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the cathedrals real fast. You of course, the book is called, the book at least that got you set off on this path is called The Mystery of the Cathedrals. And one thing real fast, mention a little bit, if you would, about, I don't think people are really familiar with the scale of the projects, you know, that the cathedrals actually were. There were some, I don't know, 400 or 500 of them built in a pretty short period of time, a couple hundred
years.
That's
right. In fact, yeah, if you did about 15 years ago, did a monetary assessment of just Notre Dame in Paris, it would cost today $400 billion to build it. And there were almost 500 of these cathedrals built across Europe in a little over 100 years.
Right.
And the Catholic Church won't cop to paying for it. It's very interesting. I've traced the receipts back, and the Catholic Church was not the party that was paying for this incredible construction project. In fact, I had to finally say to myself that it's only one group that it could have possibly been, and that would be the Knights Templar. And I believe, of course, that the Knights Templar discovered something, a cache of something in their diggings underneath the Temple Mount in the early 1100s. And I believe that that's where our modern science comes from, alchemy, the building of the cathedrals, modern banking, and several other things came from a discovery, including the maps of Columbus that Columbus used to get to the New World. But this building of the cathedrals was the thing that pushed Europe over into the Renaissance and created really our modern world. Most modern historians would agree with that too, by the way. In other words, we were living in a time, 1,000 years of the Dark Ages, well, 800 years of the Dark Ages, and pretty much people didn't know how to read and write. There was a world of control by the church and by kings and dukes, and it was a fiefdoms and serfs. And suddenly, out of the blue, these building projects started, and suddenly you had to learn geometry, and you had to learn math, and you had to learn how to communicate, and you had to learn how to read and write. And this spread all across Europe, whether it would be in Prague or whether it was in England or France or Germany or Italy. It was everywhere, all going on, all at the same time. And it lifted Europe up out of ignorance and created craft guilds and Freemasonry and many, many things that advanced Europe into being really the leading intellectual center of the world. And all the way up into today. And so it was an amazing thing, but Fulcanelli actually tells us that these cathedrals were even more incredible than just a kind of uplifting of the community. They were secret. There was a secret science that was behind the building of the cathedrals. And this secret science was the same exact science that was behind the building of the pyramids or the building of the temples in India. And this science was a hyperdimensional science. It was a science about meta-dimensional states. And I believe that Newton, for instance, really did know everything about alchemy. It's just that if you try to explain hyperdimensional science, you're forced to use words and metaphors and analogies that are difficult to understand, because there's no way a three-dimensional person can talk about fourth and fifth-dimensional space and time without it sounding kind of weird. But I believe that cathedrals, I know that cathedrals are transducers. They take hyper-dimensional energy in space and they transduce it down into three dimensions, and this creates an incredible cohesion in the towns that were built around the cathedrals, and it creates a space in the head that allows your imagination to run wild. And so the same exact people, and Fulcanelli is very clear about this, the same exact science that's behind the ancient building of the pyramids in Egypt is exactly the same exact science that's behind the building of the Gothic cathedrals. In fact, the building of the Gothic cathedrals are the largest building project ever on Earth outside of the building of the Great Pyramids in Egypt. So it's quite an amazing thing, and the fact that it isn't talked about at all, not discussed at all, that it's being given one or two sentences in history books and then written off like it isn't important is disturbing. And I think it's time for us to realize that we're sitting on a literal gold mine of incredible information, and it's time, now that we're nearing the end of time, it's time to have this information not only released but understood.
Right. Well, you know, Jay, you mentioned this difficulty in explaining these ideas, and I think one of the things that that sort of exacerbates that is this, and you bring this up in your video, this idea of the reductionist versus holist, for example. You made a wonderful statement that said science looks down into matter and alchemy looks up into spirit. And I thought that was just a beautiful metaphor for what you were trying to say here. And I think the cathedrals appear to me, at least, to be sort of the physical manifestation of that sort of a statement.
They are. And I like to put it like this. The three-dimensional world is a horizontal world. And the fourth-dimensional world is a vertical world. And so the snake is the symbol of the horizontal world. And when the snake goes upright, like in the caduceus, it is how the 3D is transformed into the 4D or into the hyperdimensional. The cathedrals are really homages to a vertical a vertical dimension, a vertical science. And this vertical science is how the fourth dimension interacts with the third dimension.
Okay.
The fourth dimension is literally coming down from above. And one of the things that makes human beings so special and why we are actually one of the most important things in the entire universe is the fact that we walk upright. We are walking tangentially to this, to these 4D forces which are coming down from above. And so when our spine is straight and when we're walking upright, we're receiving these forces at their maximum, as opposed to animals which are horizontal,
mm-hmm.
with their backbones at horizontal. And so this is why the ancients thought that man or humans were the paragon of creation, and why the earth was at the center of the universe. They didn't necessarily believe that we really were at the center of the universe, but because of our peculiar physical form, we were very, very important. This is why in yoga you have to keep your back straight.
Mm.
Why in all these ancient arts, it's very important about how one walks and talks and holds themselves, because we are a creature. I call us, the human beings are 3.5-dimensional creatures. Our bodies are in the 3D, lead, and our minds are in 4D, gold.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think up thoughts, or when I talk, like I'm talking to you, or when you talk to me, or when we talk to each other, we're language is a hyper-dimensional activity, and I can paint pictures in your mind, and you can paint pictures in my mind just by using a series of grunts and groans that animals could use.
Right.
But human beings have the ability to actually transform reality through language, which was a favorite subject of one of my good friends, Terence McKenna.
Sure, sure.
And we know that language and the mammalian brain and the opposing thumbs all developed all at the same time. You know, what is evolution, you know, really? Is evolution just a series of random processes, or is it an interaction between lower forces of the third dimension and the upper forces of the fourth, fifth, and sixth dimensions? And frankly, I choose the latter. Okay. I think that that is really what the subject of alchemy is looking at, discussing, and trying to make available to everyone. And by the way, I think that for some reason, these concepts, which 20 years ago I couldn't get my dog to listen to, are suddenly, everyone is beginning to get them.
Right.
And I don't know why that is, but it is true, and I've seen it in my own life. I just keep saying the same thing over and over, but people are listening now, and they're understanding. And so there is something funny going on right now that's really quite amazing.
No question about it. I feel the force of your words, trust me.
All
right, so the cathedrals were sort of built with that in mind, too, right? So they were built as sort of these vertical receivers of this energy, too.
Yeah, in the alchemy terms, or in Celtic mythology, they're called telluric forces.
Mm, okay.
And, you know, the Orgone, if you're Wilhelm Reich,
sure.
or if you're Paul LaViolette, it's Aetherions. Everyone has a different name for it.
Right.
But the telluric forces come down from above, and they're captured by the steeples. And then they're brought to the floor of the Gothic cathedrals, where the people come in communal worship. And by the way, if you go to Europe or even here in America and you look at where the cathedrals are built, they're always built at the highest hill in town.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an accident.
Yeah,
that is for a reason.
Right.
Spreading out and moving through the village as it comes down from above. So you take higher dimensional forces, and through the granite of the rock, just like the same rock in the pyramids is granite, and it acts as a transducer and spreads higher dimensional energy out among horizontally. It takes it from the vertical and spreads it out horizontally, transforming the community itself, which historians say, oh, the building of the Gothic cathedrals transformed Europe. But the alchemists would say, no, the buildings themselves
did.
Transformed
okay.
Europe.
Okay, all right. Well, and, you know, before I go on to the next thing I was going to ask you, we should mention this just for a second. And just to put the aesthetic on this, for anybody who's been in one of these places, that becomes immediately apparent. I've been to a number of the cathedrals in Europe. My favorite, I guess, is Chartres, south of Paris. But they're all, at least all the ones that I've been in, have this, I don't know, atmosphere, aura, energy, whatever you want to call it, just like Jay is saying. And you cannot help but be put into a different place when you enter these places. I mean, there's no question about it, especially if you have the opportunity to go there during maybe a quieter time when there's not a zillion people shuffling through. You know, it's amazing when you start to look at it closely.
Yeah, and also there, people don't realize, but the Gothic cathedrals were actually built around chants. They were built around Gregorian chants. In other words, a Gregorian chant was composed, and then they built the cathedral around the chant. In other words, the cathedral was built to enhance the audio power of the Gregorian chant. And if you've ever been in Chartres or Notre Dame, when a Gregorian choir is doing a cappella chanting, it will floor you.
Oh, yeah.
Literally knock you off your feet.
Yep, and I think that ties back into language like you were talking about before, Jay. So
it absolutely does. Language is a higher dimensional lattice that allows 4D to be transduced into 3D.
Okay. All right, I tell you what, we're just about to the bottom of the hour. Let's take a break here. When we come back, Jay, let's talk about in 1957 there was an additional chapter that was added to this enigmatic book that you're talking about, The Mystery of the Cathedrals. It was written by, again, another enigmatic character. We don't even know that much about him to this day, that we call Fulcanelli, right?
Yep.
Okay, so when we come back, we're going to talk about the significance of this this additional chapter that was added after the fact, and what that was all about, okay?
Yep.
All right, back in just a few minutes. This is Mike Hagen. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN 89.5 FM. And my guest is Jay Widener, and we're having a wonderful talk about alchemy and soon to get into the Great Cross of Hendaye. In the meantime, it's sort of an apocalyptic evening tonight, and hope you're in sort of an eschatological state of mind. And with that in mind, here's a little more for you. Back in just a few minutes, this is Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN.
Fury's breathing down your neck. think the end of the world as we know it. It's think the end of the world as we know it.
It's REM from document number 5. It's the end of the world as we know it. And it just very well may be. And we're going to be getting a little bit further into that a little bit later in the program tonight with my guest Jay Widener, the author of A Monument to the End of Time, among other books, publications, videos. And we're talking to Jay live from Seattle tonight. And all right, Jay, let's get back into it here. We're talking about this book, The Mystery of the Cathedrals, and apparently it was originally written in like 1926, and I think, or thereabouts, and then some 30 years later, apparently, they add, I'm not sure exactly, I guess you give us the details, but a chapter was added. Maybe we can start there.
Yeah, the book was printed in 1926, and there was only really 300 copies printed.
Wow.
And it was a hardcover book. And it became as rare as chicken's teeth, and no one really read it. It was just kind of a rumor because the rich people bought it, and so there was only 300 people who even owned copies. And, you know, a lot of people wondered what it was really about.
Okay.
And in 1957, they decided to do a mass publication of it. So they printed it up, and they put out 5,000 copy, and then later a 10,000 copy. They translated it into English. In 1959, I think they Neville Spearman printed 10,000 copies, which I own one of those copies.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the book got out. It actually had a big influence on the creation of the New Age, because the book Morning of the Magicians, which is really the book that's considered to have started the New Age.
Powell's and Bergier.
It spends a good third of the book talking about Fulcanelli. In fact, Jacques Bergier actually says he met Fulcanelli, which he may or may not have. But
right, Powell sort of considered Bergier an alchemist in his own right, I think.
Well, he was. Yeah, he had a lab and everything.
Right.
The most interesting thing, and by the way, this is hardly discussed or noticed or anything, which in itself is, you know, the dog that didn't bark in the middle of the night, is the fact that even though Fulcanelli had disappeared from the world right after 1926, there was a new chapter added to the book. And the chapter was called The Cyclic Cross of Hyundai, or Hyundai in French.
Okay.
And this was about a strange, obscure monument in a churchyard found in a town called Hyundai in the southwestern corner of France, right across the border from Spain. As I said earlier, Hitler had visited Hyundai. Louis XIV was married there. It was it's an odd little town. And this chapter, only 6 pages long, is probably one of the most profound documents ever written in esoteric lore. And again, no one has really ever discussed it much outside of Fulcanelli until I happened to come along and wonder why this new chapter was in this book.
Right.
As I read the chapter and tried to figure out what it was saying, I realized, of course, that this strange, obscure monument called the Cross of Hyundai was discussing the fact that the world was going to end soon, or this age was going to end soon. And Fulcanelli is quite explicit about this in the chapter that he writes. And armed with Fulcanelli's clues, I and my co-writer began really pursuing exactly what the Cross of Hyundai was saying. And through the examination of the Cross of Hyundai, I discovered many obscure ancient concepts, and through these ancient concepts I was able to understand the nature of time and reality in a more profound way than I do now. Needless to say, what the Cross of Hende is saying is that this age, which Fulcanelli calls the Age of Iron, which is the age that we live in right now, is coming to a close, a rather dramatic close. And we are, I believe, about 7 years away from this dramatic closing of our age, which I believe will happen in 2012. And indeed, many of the things that are going on in the world seem to confirm and substantiate that feeling. Interestingly enough, the cross indicates that there's going to be a 20-year period at the end of time, which is going to be quite turbulent. And the Mayan calendar, which also ends in 2012, breaks up their time periods into cartoons, which are 20-year periods.
Right.
And so the last 20-year period of the age began in 1992 and is ending in 2012. It began 1991-92, somewhere in that time. It's ending somewhere around 2011-2012.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, almost exactly halfway in that time period is 911, which in itself has a lot of strange things going on with it. So it's uncanny and it's weird, and I think that even the elites that rule our country and the world think that possibly something odd is going to happen here soon, and they seem to be preparing for it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Before you tell us about the cross itself, I've got a couple questions real fast about this. The second publication. Initially, there were only 300 books printed. As you say, it was really obscure. In fact, it was sort of a mystery. Nobody even knew if it was real. And then, 30 years later, somebody. And I guess that's my first question. Who was behind the second publication? Do we know anything about the person or people that were behind it? The follow-up to that would be, why wait? Why wait 30 years to publish the additional
paper? Well, the second question is really a great question. I don't know about the first question. It was just the rumor mills about the book were so hot, someone in the publishing world in Paris decided that it was worth while doing it. Mm-hmm. So they got a copy of one of the original 300 and basically reset the type and printed it up.
Okay.
Now, that's at least the prosaic story behind it. I believe, of course, that the whole reason that it was reprinted was to add the second chapter, add the last chapter on Hende. And the reason that was because it was now time to release the final information. In other words, 1926 wasn't the right time for it, but 1957 was the right time, because this was the time of what you might call the terminal generation, or the last generation, the last full generation, the baby boom generation, whatever you want to call it, that was starting to emerge at that time. It was meant to have a heavy influence on that generation, so that that generation would become interested in what it was all about and discover its secrets and give a rebirth to alchemy. And this rebirth to this ancient science of alchemy would decimate the age of materialism and science. So it's all a wild thing that's going on. I believe, of course, I don't really believe, while there may have been a man named Fulcanelli, I'm no argument with that. I believe that Fulcanelli is a member of a very, very, very enlightened, advanced group of individuals who live in the Pyrenees Mountains of France. And this group is very similar to kind of the Harry Potter thing. In fact, the first Harry Potter movie is based on a Fulcanelli legend, believe it or not. I'm sure that J.K. Rowling had read this legend and based the first book on this legend of a school in a giant in the mountains where people, initiates, were taken and taught the alchemical arts.
Hmm.
And this group, I call them the Masters of Light, I guess, for lack of a better term, they're the midwives to the birth of the Golden Age, which follows the death of the Iron Age.
Right.
And so they're pounding the nails in the coffin of the Iron Age, and they're all at the same time they're giving birth to the Golden Age. And so this book and this chapter was really meant to do that. And again, I have to emphasize that the entire New Age, of which I'm not really a New Age follower, but it's important to note that the entire New Age really emerged because of Fulfinelli.
Mm-hmm.
His influence, or the group's influence, is deep. It's wide and it's deep. And that is really of great significance. And when you finally understand what the chapter of Hende is really telling you, then you realize that a profound event is unfolding in front of our eyes. But because it's unfolding so slowly, we don't recognize it. We don't see it. We just see snapshots of it. But if you could fly backwards and see the larger movie,
mm-hmm.
the collection of snapshots, you would see that there is a very profound thing going on in the human race right now. And it's really built around a kind of initiation of the human race. History is an initiation. And we're reaching the culmination of history right now as we're speaking here. And that means that we're reaching the culmination of our collective initiation. And some people aren't going to make it. Some people are. And that's the way it is.
Right.
But that is really why they held the chapter back until 1957.
Okay.
Not time yet.
All right. You know, as you were talking, it made me think about one of the primary differences in my own mind between those two time periods is, in 1957, the secrets of the atom had been discovered, and this was an alchemy of sorts on its own.
Yes, it was a dangerous alchemy.
A very dangerous alchemy. Sort of breaking the cosmic rules, you know.
Yes, it was, and they realized with the breaking of the atom that, in fact, this is what the author Bergier of Morning of the Magicians, when he met Fulcanelli actually told him, Bergier was a nuclear physicist, and actually told him that the splitting of the atom was alchemy, that the alchemists had known about it for thousands of years, of which I firmly believe that, and that this was the most dangerous moment in the history of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it goes right back to what you're saying there. It was now time to break up the strident materialistic science. It was time to throw a monkey wrench into the cogwheels of quote, progress, unquote. And Fulcanelli's intentions, to me, are clear that this is what he's doing. Once you understand hyperdimensional science, you realize what the splitting of the atom really is, and then you realize why it is so dangerous.
Hmm.
Because it can literally cause holes to open between dimensions, and all sorts of little beasties can get through.
Mm-hmm.
And so this becomes very problematic, but that too will cause the end of time. So everything is working together to create the end of time, but I don't want to be pessimistic, because
right.
Fulcanelli is very clear in saying that a golden age will follow the end of the Iron Age.
Right.
And the golden age is a time of it's an incredible time. And lead into gold, it's about the time, it's about the change, about mm-hmm. the enculturation, the initiation that happens to the human species as we grow and mature out of our childhood's end, as Arthur C. Clarke would say.
Another wonderful book, yeah.
Yes, all about this if you really read it very carefully.
That's right, I agree with you.
Yeah, and again, 2001 by Stanley Kubrick is all about this. Interestingly enough, he chooses 2001 which is the right near the middle date of this. And again, the movie is about the creation of a new being who is transformed by going through a hyperdimensional gate.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is what that movie is about. And so everything works full circle here. Why would a movie as obscure and as odd as 2001 be a huge hit in 1968 when it was released?
Right, and
yet it was.
And to this day, just, you know, still in the cultural mind, you know?
Absolutely. Every single good science fiction movie owes a debt to Stanley and 2001. And they're all, in a way, kind of trying to make their own 2001 to be as profound as Stanley. But they weren't ensconced in this alchemical tradition like Stanley was.
Right.
And that's why Stanley moved to England and got away from America. He wanted to get as close to this European sense of upper and higher dimensional science as he could, and a careful viewing of all of his films reveals that he knows what he's talking about, and he is trying to tell you great and profound things, as is his co-writer Arthur C. Clarke. And again, Arthur C. Clarke, his roommates that were staying with him in the 60s during the time that he was writing 2001 were the people who started NASA.
Hmm.
They were German scientists coming over on Operation Paperclip,
sure,
who were waiting for their papers to be processed so they could come over to Houston. And Clark and they would sit around all night with Stanley talking about these really very, very advanced concepts.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, Morning of the Magicians, earlier, and for anybody out there, if you get a chance to get a copy of that book, that'll throw you for a loop.
It's a great book.
It is a fantastic book, no doubt. But they, Bergier and Powell's talk in there about this, the German philosophy of science, and about how different it really was from the Western sort of Einsteinian relativism that was being pushed here. And
okay.
And the scientists were working under completely different auspices and with different assumptions, and it really was a whole different mindset.
It was, and it should be noted, of course, that the Foo Fighters and the first UFOs all emerged out of this. And what are, you know, UFOs? And if you understand hyperdimensional science, then you realize that a hyperdimensional vehicle would most likely be round, it would most likely be spinning, it would most likely be glowing with light at night, it would most likely have the ability to look like it's morphing. So if you videotape it, each frame would look a little bit different than the other frame. And indeed, over Mexico City in 1991, during the famous sightings, slowing down the videotapes that were taken, hundreds of UFOs that were watching the major eclipse there at 19.5.
That's right.
Mexico City.
That's right.
And they were morphing. You know, it's really quite astonishing. And so what is going on here? And what is going on is that the interaction between dimensions is increasing. It's going into hyperstasis, and there are literally hyperdimensional beings that are interacting with us right now, whereas they actually weren't interacting with us before. Why they're coming here now, I don't know, but they are. And it's all just really incredibly fascinating, and it's actually the only story there is right now as far as I'm concerned.
All right, it seems like all the other stuff is either diversionary purposefully or just out of ignorance, but either way, that the effect is the same, that the masses. I read a story before I had you on the air about there was from Istanbul, it's a real short story, but a whole bunch of sheep followed the leader sheep off of a cliff. And I sort of just use it as a metaphor and said, you know, look what
the sheeple.
Yeah, and it seems like for whatever reason, you know, the culture generally is uninterested in this stuff.
And that is as it should be. Only the people who are interested, the people that are listening to this show and things like that, they're the only ones that really, really count. And I mean, I hate to sound so callous, but it's, and you should have compassion for all those people who don't know and don't care, but, and you should do everything you can to help them and enlighten them as to what's really going on. But for those who don't know and don't care, well, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, what are you going
to
do?
We have to keep talking among ourselves. Mm. And we're constantly, you know, with the internet and shows like this and research, we're always raising the ante on this thing.
That's
so great about it.
Yeah, no question.
And so everybody's raising the ante, and they're all comparing notes now because of the internet, and so our knowledge is just skyrocketing.
Right.
Before the end of time, everything will be known.
Yeah.
Within the next 7 years, everything that's worth knowing will be known.
It really is astonishing, because you make the point that it does seem like at the same time all of our problems are sort of coming to a head at the same time as this huge outbreak of information and creativity and all these things, and it really is sort of a tug of war maybe between those two things, it seems like. Information versus power, something like that.
Yeah, information. Information's what's loose on this planet right now.
Right.
And the people in power can't put the genie back in the bottle, and they don't know what to do about it. Their whole corporate state is ruled by quick communication via the internet, so they really can't censor the internet.
Right, and they can't
so
take down
this
the
is why internet. They haven't censored the internet, and so they're stymied, and they don't know really what's happening, and so underneath, you know, why the giant dinosaurs are dying and being caught in the tar pits. You know, the little mammals are scurrying around in the deep underbrush, eventually going to replace the dinosaurs as the dominant species, and that's what's going on now.
Right.
Underneath the underbrush of the internet are the new humans are scurrying around, creating a whole new paradigm that's literally blowing the other paradigm out the water, and of course, people like us talk to people like them, and you might as well be talking to a wall, you know. So, and of course, this seems to be the biggest complaint going nowadays among enlightened people, is how, when they try to explain things about what's really going on to other people, they get a blank stare, a bored look. I'm sure all of the people who are listening know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I started doing my radio show. I realized that I couldn't sell it. In other words, me going out and trying to tell people, you know, ideas that I was entertaining and different things and this and that that were just interesting to me, became a point where you just realized it didn't make, nobody wanted to hear it. So I decided, well, I'll just start doing a radio show, and then the people that do want to hear it, maybe they'll listen to the show, you know. So.
And they will. And it's truly an amazing time to be alive.
It's
scary. But it's extremely exciting.
It sure is.
It is.
I could not agree more. All right, well, I'll tell you what. It's a little bit before the top of the hour, so let's do it. Let's take a break here. We'll come back, and then let's talk about the cross.
All right.
Let's talk about we probably won't have enough time to go too deeply into how you deciphered what you deciphered, but we could talk certainly about all the images that are on the base, and I want to talk about the inscription and the Latin.
Yeah, they can get the video if they want to get into it in depth, or one of the books.
Right, and we'll do that as soon as we come back, all right?
All right.
Okay, you guys, this is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. My guest is Jay Widener, and we're having a wonderful conversation about alchemy and the true science that it really is and was, and also some related things, including this interesting cross at Hendaye, France, that we're going to talk about as soon as we get back. So stick around. We'll be back in just a few minutes. In the meantime, this is Chris Cornell from Euphoria Morning, another Seattle boy, one of my favorites. And back again in just a few minutes with Jay Widener. This is Radio Orbit, KOPN.
But I know now that it wasn't me. You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
All right, some of the operating funds for KOPN are provided by listener support and, from a donation from the Blue Note. Information about the Blue Note is available at www.thebluenote.com. Or you can call them at 573-874-1944. Yeah, good stuff. The Blue Note been bringing music here now for 25 years. Going on 26, too. Thanks to Richard and everybody over there. Always enjoy good music. And in fact, Kenny Wayne Shepherd coming up next Wednesday. I'll probably do a promo for that a little bit later, but that's something that is coming to the Blue Note in just a few days. And I will be there. All right, this is Mike Hagan, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN, Columbia. My guest tonight is Jay Widener, and we're going to get right back to him here. We're talking about alchemy. A gentleman named Falconelli and this mysterious cross in the town of Hende, France. So, Jay, let's start there. Let's talk about this cross and what it looks like and then what it means.
Yeah, the cross is just a churchyard outside of the cathedral there in Hende. And it's about 12 feet tall. It has a pedestal. It's about 3.5 feet tall. It has four engravings on each side of the pedestal. There's a Greek column on top of the pedestal, and then a Greek cross on top of the column. On one side of the Greek cross are the four letters that were above Jesus as he was on the cross, I-N-R-I, and on the other side is a strange Latin inscription which is broken as it reads. And the Latin inscription ostensibly says, "Hail, O cross, the only hope," which is a medieval Christian phrase that was frequently on gravestones across France and England and Germany at the time.
Okay. Hey,
Four drawings on the pedestal are, one is on the east side, is a kind of an exploding eight-sided star. On the north side is a fairy tale moon. On the west side is an Aztec-looking angry sun face,
mm-hmm.
And on the south side is a strange oval with four odd-looking A's in each of the quadrants. The oval has a cross in it, and each of the quadrants has a strange-looking A, with instead of a straight crossbar, the A has a right-angled crossbar, looking very much like a Freemasonic symbol.
Okay.
Okay, it doesn't sound like much.
Well, hey, Jay, let me jump in real fast, too. For people, if you want to get a visual of this, you can, again, go to my site and just click on that image or Jay's name or whatever, and that'll take you over to jaywidener.com. And there's plenty of pictorial and visual representations of the stuff that we're talking about right now. So if you have your computers on, jump up and get on the web, and you can look and see exactly what Jay's talking about here. Okay.
Yeah, either the Topology of Time, which is one of the top articles there, right on the first page has pictures of it. Of course, there's a picture of me standing next to the cross in front of the website. And why is this cross important, I guess, is the real question. Well, as I began, you know, deciphering the cross slowly, I found out a lot of really odd things. I found out that there was a tarot card relationship to the images on the four pedestal, the four images on the pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, number 17 of the tarot deck is an eight-sided exploding out star. Number 18, notice that we're in succession.
Right,
18
right.
Is a fairy tale moon. Number 19 is a sun with a face, and number 20 is not an odd oval with four A's in it, but it is the Day of Judgment.
Hmm.
And so you can see that the cross is leading you through this ancient science of tarot cards, leading you to the Day of Judgment. I believe, of course, that the tarot cards are actually another way that the 4D and 5D space is transduced down into 3D. The moment, of course, that you outlay your tarot cards is of a description of time. Time is really a shadow of fourth dimensional space.
Mm.
And so, you know, this cross seems to be directing you towards the Day of Judgment, which, of course, is a Christian and Kabbalist term for the end of time. At the end of time, at the end of the great procession of the equinoxes, it's like the cycle of reincarnations come to an end. So you do reincarnate, but you only reincarnate for a certain cycle of time. And then at the end, you're weighed, your soul is weighed. In ancient Egypt, you know, when you died, your heart was weighed, and it had to be lighter than a feather.
Mm.
If it wasn't, then you didn't get to ascend. And so you're weighed by, did you live a life that was full of value, and did you live a life of compassion and integrity? And so the end of time, you know, very close to what it says in the book of Revelation, we are all kind of judged. I don't know if it's the fierce judgment of God, or if it's a kind of a weighing of the soul, a weighing of, did you turn your soul into light?
Hmm.
You know, did you spend your time wisely while you were here? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think at the end of time, which the cross is pointing at, is that time period, and I think we're approaching it really rather quickly.
And so this also ties into the Mayan calendar, and then the Kali Yuga, or the Hindu ideas of the Yugas as well,
I guess.
So all these things are sort of pointing towards the same thing, in other words.
Well, it's interesting.
Or
as my research went on, I discovered, you know, a person that later became a good friend of mine, John Major Jenkins, had written a book called Maya Cosmogenesis 2012,
right.
Of which he deciphered the Mayan calendar and realized that it was coming to an end with the galactic alignment, where the sun and the galaxy are rising at the same time on the winter solstice of 2012. Well, then that caused me to go look at other end-of-the-world theologies from ancient cultures, and I discovered that, of course, I'll get into the Peruvian thing in a few minutes, but I discovered that in Tibet, that they said that Shambhala, which is their sacred city,
right.
would be recreated on Earth and being built from the sky in 2012. I learned that the Zeptepi, which is called the first time,
right,
translated
Egyptian.
As the first time in ancient Egypt, also was going to happen at this time period. And when I interpreted the broken Latin inscription on the cross, which I'm not going to get into now because it's a little complicated, but one can go either get the DVD or the books and figure out, you know, watch my blow-by-blow description of how I deciphered the broken Latin inscription. It points to another cross in Peru and also caves in Cusco, Peru.
Mm.
When I went to Cusco and Peru, I learned that the Peruvian shamans believed that time was coming to an end in 2012 and that a new species called Homo luminis was about to emerge. And so there I had four different cultures from four different places on Earth, from four different time periods, all pointing at 2012 as being some incredible culmination of history. And in crime investigations, I used to be a journalist, you wanted at least, when you were dealing with circumstantial evidence, you needed to have at least three different sources that confirmed your circumstantial evidence before you could really go forward and say that this circumstantial evidence rises above the prosaic and actually has something to do with the crime. Well, the same thing applies here. You find three or four cultures from different places on Earth that are all saying that something profound is going to happen in 2012, then it's time to maybe start taking that seriously.
Mm.
And I do. And I live my life in the way that I think that time is starting to unravel, come to an end, And what that means is anybody's guess.
Right. You know, it's interesting, and I'll mention something here to my listeners. It is rather complicated the way Jay translates this inscription. And my first instinct was that it was a stretch, and I'll be honest with you, until the Urkos thing came up.
Yep.
And then the cross was there. And that was sort of the kicker for me. I mean, everything else makes sense as well, but I think it was more of an intellectual problem for me, the understanding of the deciphering of the Latin inscription, and maybe I just didn't spend enough time on it or whatever. But the bottom line is, this stuff is paying out, and the things that are theoretically coming together on paper are showing up in real life in the hills of Peru.
Well, they are. It's interesting. Right after A Monument to the End of Time came out in 1999 with the Peru research in it, I'd been to Peru a few times and I'd found a lot of incredibly profound things there. But right at that moment, right when the book came out, actually came out in 99, but it really came out in a big publication in September 2000.
Mm-hmm.
In October, late October of 2000, essentially the Peruvian government was more or less overthrown by the New World Order.
Mm.
And they put in their own guy. They had I forget his name now, he was a Japanese Peruvian gentleman who was actually a pretty good president. And he had taken Peru out of the shining path, communist
mm-hmm.
rebels,
mm-hmm.
And really saved the economy of Peru, and the people really liked him. And all of a sudden he was thrown out, and a Harvard-educated man was put in, and all of a sudden there were armed guards around the cave openings in Peru, and it was almost like I had accidentally caused some kind of clampdown, which I felt kind of bad about, actually, and still do, because I had no idea that they were as interested in this stuff as I was, and that they're still very interested in it. The certain powers that be are very interested in this esoteric work, and
for what
reason, I have no idea.
Right.
So, and I have to agree with you. Even I thought that, you know, my breakdown of the Latin inscription was a stretch, but when I discovered the Urkos signal coming backwards to the top word, what could I do? I mean, my jaw just dropped to the floor.
Yeah.
I just said, you know, my God, what are the chances of this?
Well,
especially because Fulcanelli warns us in this chapter that once you understand what the Latin inscription is really telling you, you'll understand that it's naming a country,
mm-hmm.
a country where the cataclysm that is coming won't reach. And here it was. It was named Peru. What could I do, you know?
And so, just to clarify, that's such an important point. So Fulcanelli points to this clue as saying that this is going to be a safe place when when the wave hits, whatever that might
that's
be.
That's right.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, I went to Peru and I found these incredible caves. And then I found that it was a kind of just a blasé thing, that there was these huge, miles-long caves that had been carved by humans running all under the Andes Mountains, and that Pizarro believed that the Inca had hidden their gold there, and they weren't just, you know, they were everywhere.
Right.
And David Hatcher Childress, who's a friend of mine, he's actually, you know, walked through these things,
mm-hmm.
you know, miles through these things, and I thought, my God, this is, you know, completely astonishing that there's this gigantic tunnel system running underneath the Andes Mountains and that the Cross of Hende is pointing at it. And then I began thinking, you know, okay, so let's say that something happens, asteroids hit or a galactic wave or a pole shift or any number of scenarios that could happen that could deal a disaster. Where would you want to be? And then I realized, of course, you would want to be first underground, so you're protected, And then two, you'd want to be way high up in case there were tidal waves. Mm-hmm. And there you are at, you know, 13,000 feet, 14,000 feet, one of the highest places, the highest cities in the world is Cusco. And there's the caves. And you would be protected in this cave network.
And you're telling me now, though, that these caves have basically been commandeered by government military types or something?
Yeah, they have been. They have been always kind of commandeered by them because people used to get lost in them. Mm. So they would have to spend, you know, thousands and thousands of pesos trying to get people out. There's a famous story of a mass on a Sunday in Santo Domingo Cathedral in Cusco in the 30s. And when the choir finished singing one of their songs, everybody in the church, you know, heard this mad slamming on the floor below them. And so after the mass, they kind of broke open the floor, and they found a guy who had been lost in the tunnel system for 2 weeks, and he had come towards the church because he'd heard the singing. And he'd crawled his way through, and they found this huge tunnel system underneath the church that ran all the way across the Sacred Valley and came out all the way on the other end of the Sacred Valley. So the Peruvian government has concreted off many of these openings now so you can't get in because of, I don't know, various reasons, I guess. And, yeah, but it's a well-known fact that, you know, that you basically, if you get caught in the tunnel system, you're on your own. They're not going to come get you anymore.
All right.
And so everyone kind of stays out. However, the Inca, or actually the Quechua people that live there, have assured me that they know the tunnel system very well.
That's
and
right.
They used it to get away from Pizarro and the Spanish.
Very interesting. You know, there are a couple things I want to mention to you that you brought to mind. First of all, there was a book that I read many years ago, and it was called The Secret of the Andes. And it's written by this guy, talk about an enigma, it goes by Brother Philip. Anyway, he talked quite a bit in there about these underground labyrinthian cave and tunnel systems where initiations may go on and things like that in Peru. And then when I got more familiar with your material, that was just another confirmation of that, again, from a completely obscure and other source, you know?
Well, David Hatcher Childress reports, can't remember which book it is, but there's a huge rumor that Fulcanelli, well, we know that Marconi disappeared mysteriously in the 30s.
Right, right.
And the rumor has it that Marconi and Fulcanelli went to Peru and started an alchemical school somewhere in the vast wilderness. I'll tell you this, if you wanted to get lost on this planet, Peru is the place to go.
The place to do
it. I mean, it is obscure. There's four ecosystems, the driest desert on Earth, the wettest jungle on Earth, the highest mountains on Earth. You could get lost in one of those valleys and never be seen again.
Man, oh man, you know, you just made me think of something else too. And I talk about alchemy, and I think this goes back to Athanasius Kirchner or someone like that. But he said, the oldest books, the highest mountains, the furthest countries, the deepest forest. This is where you must seek the stone.
Well, that's interesting because Alberto Viotto, who's a shaman who goes to Peru all the time, told me that the Quechua have told him that there are giant libraries in the Andes Mountains. And they're waiting until the end of time to bring all the information out. Also, when I was in Peru, I would hang around in Cusco and talk to people, and some hikers told me a story that had happened a year before I had gone there, where a couple was up high in the mountains hiking alone, and they heard strange chanting going on, and they looked over a hill, and there was a group of white men in literally levitating the water out of a lake. And they looked, and one of the men looked and saw that the hikers had saw them, and they woke up 30 miles away. like 2 days later, and they don't remember anything else.
Oh my God.
So these stories are going on all the time in that area, by the way.
Yeah, it's just talk about a psychedelic area. This is just a whole psychedelic thing that's going on down there.
Well, on top of that, the major, the most psychedelics in the entire, organic psychedelics in the entire world, of course, where are they found?
Yeah, they grow right there.
That's right.
Right.
Very strange.
Well,
it's a fascinating place, though.
That is something else, and Peru is a place that might have to go on the list of visits for sure. Hey, you know,
I highly recommend it.
You know, speaking of that, I wanted to mention something too. We haven't talked yet about the actual cross itself being there, and I want to know if you had this. I actually went there myself. I got married in September of 2001, and for our honeymoon we went to the Basque area of France there and Spain, and we stayed. And part of the reason was because of your book. I'd been reading Monument for about a year. It took me a long time to get through it, quite frankly, because it's a pretty sophisticated book. And anyway, as I was reading it, I was sort of like, you know, trying to come up with a way to celebrate my wedding and all this stuff. My wife wanted to go to Europe, but I didn't want to do something passé. I wanted to do something cool. So anyway, we found a great place to stay down there, and we went to Undai. And I mean, when I finally found it in that little town. Of course, there's a casino there, and there's all this stuff going on, and nobody knows where it's at. And it was actually sort of, even knowing what I was looking for, it was hard to find. But when we found it, I sort of was just like, whoa, it's real. Here it is, and I've got a picture exactly like the one that's on your homepage of myself right in that position, and me and my wife laughed so hard about it last night when we were looking at the photos. But it was just this, it was really like a profound moment for me, and it was just a reader. I can't imagine what it must have been like for you when you actually stepped into that square and said, my God, there it is.
Well, it was extremely profound. My wife and I also got married in France. I dropped to my knees, actually. Completely lost all of my strength. I had been pursuing this work for 14 years, and realized that I had never really seen the cross, and wasn't even sure if it was not some kind of alchemical trick or something. You know, because alchemists like to pull little tricks.
Right.
And when I pulled up to the church there and finally found a parking place and made my way across the town, and I finally found the cross, which you're right, no one knew about it, my knees buckled. That's all I can say. I was so overwhelmed by, you know, being in front of it and touching it and, you know, being able to really understand, you know, the age of the cross of Hende, that I, you know, it just absolutely blew my mind. I've been there a couple more times since then, and it still blows my mind. By the way, the cross is really deteriorated.
Yeah.
Last time I was there a couple years ago, it had seriously deteriorated over my first visits. So that's a little disconcerting also.
Well, yep, and that's happening to so many monuments around the world, you know, but at least we've got it documented. At least there's great imagery of it now, and hopefully we can somehow reverse it and restore it or something in the future here, because it really is quite a remarkable piece of work with a story that's absolutely astonishing the deeper you get into it. And
yes.
I mean, it really is, and
especially when you consider that one of Pizarro's men in Peru drew a drawing called The Secret of the Incas, and it has exactly the four images that are on the pedestal.
Who's that? Iaya?
Guaman de Iaya.
Right.
And I mean, that's just amazing. And this is the most profound images to the Incan people. So here we are, you know, halfway around the earth. The cross is pointing at this country, and here one of the very first white people to be in Peru draws this drawing, you know, which is on the cross of Hende, and you know, synchronicities pile upon synchronicities until it becomes ridiculous.
Right, no question about it. You know, you also mentioned one thing that I want to bring up really quickly. You said this, the alchemists sometimes like to play tricks. And again, there's a connection there with the shaman and the sort of trickster god. And because the shaman
yes.
and the elders and the people I know in those, they like to play tricks too. And it's there really is a direct connection or correlation between the shaman and the alchemist. In fact, it may be sort of the same thing, just expressed differently culturally.
I agree, and that gets you into the whole idea of why are they doing these tricks.
Mm.
And then you realize, and this is what worried me about the Cross of Hende at the time, that these tricks are to open up synaptic responses in the brain. And to it's like if someone tells you a joke and they have to explain the punchline to you, it's not funny. But if you get the joke immediately, there's really no logical process for understanding a good joke. It just, it either hits you or it doesn't.
Mm.
And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to kind of create a cosmic joke that has a punchline that opens you up. It's like a Zen koan or something.
Right, right, for new ways of thinking.
It's quite amazing and quite profound, and I, of course, was afraid that the Cross of Hende wasn't even real. It was just someone, Polkinelli, trying to get me to think about things in a certain way, which was good, and I would not have been sad that much if the cross hadn't been there, but I was extremely glad it was.
Right. Well, it is there, and for anybody out there who doubts it, you're hearing it from me, too. I've been there in the flesh. I've seen it with my own eyes and climbed up on top of it and took a picture right next to it, and many of them, actually. I was photographing like crazy around there because I was thinking, I wonder if I'll catch something in one of these photos that, you know, that's significant. But
yeah.
At any rate, okay, well, it's bottom of the hour. We're going to take a break here. We'll come back, and we'll have about 20 or 25 to finish things up, so... decide how you want to close out and relax just for a few minutes, everybody, and we'll be back, okay, with Jay Widener, and we're really getting into it here, and we're going to talk about, I think, Jay, we should probably, I guess, get to this whole idea of the end of time and what it really might mean and what, I don't know, I mean, what the heck is really going on? You know?
Sounds good.
Okay, back in just a few minutes. This is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN, Columbia. It is about 1:34 in the a.m. on Tuesday morning, the 12th. Man, can't believe it. 12th of July already. And my guest, who's been kind enough to spend his evening with us tonight for the last hour and a half, and we're going to have another half hour with Jay Widener here on the phone, live from Seattle, talking about the cyclic cross at Henday and Folconelli and alchemy and all of the way that these things are sort of converging to right now, actually. And apparently, and this is not the only sign, of course, you know, this isn't the only thing we've talked about in this program. We talk about a lot of different things, and lots of things seem to be pointing in the same direction right now, Jay.
They sure do.
Lots and lots of things, and not just metaphysical things, you know, lots of different things in many, many, many different areas of human endeavor.
Well, I certainly agree with that. There's profound advances in brain chemistry science and in nanotechnology, and one just has to step back a little bit and put it all together, and they realize that if the world does go on, it's going to be one incredibly strange place in
wow.
a few years. So, you know, it's just getting stranger and stranger and weirder and weirder, and so those that can surf the waves of high weirdness are going to be the ones who make it to the beach. So
I think that's right. All right. Well, talking about waves, one of the gentlemen who was whose research sort of dovetailed and eventually helped some of your stuff make sense was a PhD astrophysicist named Paul LaViolette. And my audience is familiar with Dr. LaViolette. He's been on the show before, but I'm sure that they're not familiar with the connection between his work and yours. So let's make that connection now.
Oh, I'd love to. He's one of my favorite people.
All right, great.
Well, in 1997, I was hired by a very wealthy man in Boulder, Colorado, to put together a conference called Awakening Gaia Conference, and I brought Graham Hancock and Robert Bivol and Robert Temple and David Hatcher Childress and Jocelyn Godwin, some of the great esoteric thinkers of our time, together for a five-day conference, which was quite profound. I was like a kid in a candy store with my favorite people coming and inviting. One of the people I invited was Paul LaViolette, and I invited him because of his book Beyond the Big Bang, which was a very profound book about alchemy and hyperdimensional physics, and wanted his work to be introduced to the larger group. But when he arrived in Boulder to give his lecture, which I wanted to be on Beyond the Big Bang, he insisted that his lecture was going to be on a book that had just been written called Earth Under Fire.
Right.
We got in a small little tiff about it because I wanted it to be Beyond the Big Bang. Paul's kind of stubborn. He insisted it was going to be Earth Under Fire. I gave up finally, sat down in my seat to watch you know, this lecture on a book I knew nothing about, you know, prayed that it was going to go just fine.
Right.
And sat down, and over the next hour and a half, literally almost melted, had a meltdown in my seat as I watched his lecture. And I realized, I sprang up after the lecture, I'll never forget it. I sprang up and I ran up to the podium and I said, surely you've read Folcanelli. And he says, Folca who? And I said, you've never read any of this stuff? And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. Alchemy's a goofy science about lead into gold.
Oh, my God.
And I was just floored. So then I sat down and I told him about my research.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, what Paula Violette had discovered was the thing that really sealed the cross of Henday and the symbols on the pedestal. For Folcanelli tells us in the chapter on Henday that there's going to be a double cataclysm.
Okay,
he never explains what he means, though, by that. He just says double cataclysm.
Okay.
I had never been able to figure out what it meant. How could a pole shift or how could meteors or whatever cause a double cataclysm? But when I watched Paula Violette's lecture, I knew exactly what the pedestal meant. For what Paula Violette was saying, and some of your listeners are probably familiar with it, is that the center of the galaxy periodically has a blow-off or an explosion. And what happens is that the giant star or multi-star that is at the center of our galaxy has an explosion. This explosion is called a Seyfert galaxy.
Hmm.
7 to 15% of all galaxies in the known universe are in their explosive state. So all galaxies have an explosive state, and they have a quiescent state. So when this explosion happens, a stream of dust particles spews out from the center and rolls through the disk of the ecliptic of the galaxy. Eventually, like a wave, it hits our solar system. Okay? So the first thing that happens when the galaxy explodes is you see a star-like object exploding in the night sky. And then a while later, because light travels faster than dust, the dust storm hits, this cosmic dust storm. And it hits our solar system, and it turns the moon to blood red. And it covers the skin of the sun and begins to cause the sun to flare. Huge solar flares that bake the inner planets of the solar system. So that brought me back to the pedestal. And, of course, on the east side of the pedestal is an exploding star, and on the west side, exactly opposite of the exploding star on the pedestal, is the angry sun face.
Right, right.
And now I knew why it was an angry sun, because it was flaring from the dust storm. And oddly enough, La Violette had done ice core sample drillings in Greenland and had discovered that every 26,000 years there's a layer of iridium. Iridium is a deep space dust. It's what this dust is made of.
And rhodium.
I won't even get into the fact that iridium is a vital chemical to the alchemical process. Let's just talk about it as a space dust. As space dust, why it comes in 26,000 year cycles. Well, that is exactly the cycle of the precession of the equinoxes, this long-term clock schedule that the zodiac sign goes through, taking 26,000 years to go through. And suddenly I realized that there was some kind of connection between the precession of the equinoxes and this periodic explosion from the center of the galaxy. Furthermore, I understood what the double cataclysm meant, because first part of the cataclysm is the exploding star at the center of the galaxy. The second part is the solar flaring, which takes place sometime later. A favorite writer of mine named René Grenon, who is a French traditionalist alchemical writer, wrote many times that at the end of time, the great masters disappear. and are no longer around. And synchronicity becomes the guiding master for the humans that are left at the end of time. Because time is happening so much more quickly as we reach the end point, synchronicities pile up on synchronicities, and the perceiving person can realize that these synchronicities are sending messages.
Right.
And so, you know, what are the chances that I would have even have this conference? What are the chances that LaViolette would have just finished his book? What are the chances that he would insist on doing it? The things all begin piling up until you can't believe it, you know.
Let me throw another one on the pile, okay?
Yeah.
Paul LaViolette, when he took his core samples, right, in Greenland, the analysis that he did was done right here in Columbia, Missouri, where I'm sitting at the University of Missouri, because he had to use the reactor in order to do the carbon dating. And
right. And
I didn't know it either, but after I interviewed him, he sent me a couple. We still stay in touch. In fact, I called him the other night, and I didn't get him, but I left him a message and said, hey, you and me and Jay need to do a show together. At any rate, he sent me a note with one of the correspondences that we've had and said, oh, by the way, all the core sample work was done right there at Mizzou. And I was just like, you've got to be kidding me, you know? And again, they just keep coming and coming and coming, so.
They do, and you know, it requires almost a hyper-awareness to know why these things and what they mean and everything. But, that was probably one of the most profound events of my whole life, sitting in that lecture hall, watching this guy, this, you know, mild-mannered, bespectacled astrophysicist, confirming, you know, an obscure alchemical cross 400 years ago by an unknown builder.
Right.
Then, of course, that begs the question, how did the unknown builder know? This person who built the cross in the 1600s, and of course, Folcanelli says that the builder had, you know, profound knowledge of science and astronomy, but how could he have known?
Right.
And that just, you know, just the idea that there's people who understand hyperdimensional physics and transgalactic astronomy. The center of the galaxy wasn't even discovered until 1917.
Huh.
You can't see the center of the galaxy.
Right.
So, you know, it's incredible, actually. And again, it also points to Jenkins' work on the Mayan calendar, which, of course, is using the center of the galaxy as its prime location point.
Yeah, you've mentioned John Major Jenkins a couple times, and I know you're aware that Terrence wrote the foreword to that book, and Terrence came to that conclusion through his own interesting lens. Long before he knew anything about the Maya, quite frankly, or any of the conclusions that you've come to. I mean, his work was basically based on the old Chinese oracle, the I Ching.
Well, interestingly enough, in 1991, I spent a night showing my Henday work to Terrence. And at the time, I was having a difficult time with it. And Terrence, looked at it and looked up at me, and he says, you know, I have no idea why I'm telling you this, but this all has to do with the center of the galaxy.
My God.
And it was 6 years later before I had anything pointing at the center of the galaxy. And then, you know, that was with LaViolette. And then here we go, Terrence's prescience was astonishing.
No question about it.
And he really is the father of this whole movement. And, I owe him a great debt of gratitude. I know John Major Jenkins does, and a lot of other people.
As do I.
Yes.
And Dennis is a friend, and he's still doing great work, and he's in the background for sure, and he's watching very closely, and he's been on the show here before too, and I think we're probably going to get him on again before the end of the year. But I tell you, it is really something else what's happening right now, Jay.
Well, it sounds like a great show. I'd love to be able to hear Dennis McKenna.
Yeah, he was on the show back in November of last year, and we had a real nice conversation.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, so, you know, all these things are coalescing in such a wild way that, you know, I really am just sorry that Terrence isn't around to really see the fruition of all of his efforts. And he was on to some really profound things.
Oh, my gosh.
He passed away. He was working on the origins of alchemy in Celtic Europe and the Druid culture, and was turning me on to some stuff that, you know, one day I hopefully will be able to write a book about, which is really profound and shows that the Druids were definitely, you know, psychedelic shaman alchemists.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And very, very profound stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. Let's kind of go back to let's let the snake eat its tail here, like we've been talking about all night. Let's get back to alchemy for a second. What it really means then, as we started out talking about, that it means much more than just trying to churn base metals into gold. It means this idea of the transmutation of the self, of the human spirit somehow. And this is somehow perhaps tied into this this rollover or this change or this end of the age or the end of time or however we want to define it. This is somehow connected to that? It must be.
Yeah, the human species is the lead, and through the through time and through history, that lead is transmuted into gold. So, in history, you know, one of the most amazing things about, especially modern history, is the fact that we're even still here. The idea that, you know, we could have somehow survived thousands and thousands of megaton weapons pointed at each other, and not one of them ever went off, not one of them ever, you know, did the damage that they could have done so horribly, shows that there's like some invisible hand on the rudder of history. And that invisible hand is there, and it's guiding history. History is a terrifying, sometimes, initiation, leading us towards something that is filled with great profundity. And history is that, is the process of that initiation. For those who have been initiated, really initiated, they know that initiations are incredibly dangerous, incredibly frightening, and also incredibly enervating. And that's what we're going through now, and we're reaching that culmination point right now. And it's going to be a white knuckle ride. It's going to be a make or break situation. It already is. And all of the people who aren't, you know, telling us the truth are really being exposed. I mean, maybe they're not being exposed to everybody, but there's a large group of people that just cannot be fooled anymore.
Right.
And, you know, that's part of it, too. It's really a great time, and I encourage everyone to, you know, hold on, because it's going to get just weirder and better and stranger, and if we can slip through the wormhole that exists at the end of time, we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, that is the trick here. Like and you mentioned a birthing event, and that's a metaphor that Terrence used to like to use as well. And that is sort of what history is. This it's been a long gestation, and we are now at the narrow neck. And like you say, the outcome, anytime you're in that sort of a situation, it is an initiation. It is the end of life as you know it into something new.
Well, Terrence used to say that, you know, what if you were wandering around in a building and you opened up a door and you found, you know, this woman covered in blood and screaming? Your first reaction would be, you know, something absolutely horrible is going on here. But then, you know, you would learn that, oh, actually she's giving birth to a baby. And that's really the analogy. Sometimes our initial reactions to what is going on is of horror, but then as we begin to understand, we realize that it isn't really nearly as nasty as we think it is. And I really do believe, I mean, I don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish or anything, but I really do believe this, and I really think that you know, we just try to stay on the surfboard as long as you can.
Right.
You know?
I couldn't agree more. I'm certainly not hopeless, and I think there is reason for hope, and I think there's a lot of good reasons for it. Again, like we talked about earlier, there are lots and lots of things that are happening right now that are remarkable, amazing things that are happening, good things that are happening at the same time as all these horrible things are happening. They're all happening at the same time.
Yeah, anything can happen now. That's the thing. Anything can happen.
That's right.
And yeah, it's a quantum realization, and once you understand that we really kind of do make our reality, that this really is a reflective universe, that it reflects our thoughts back at us, then it's time to, take control of the situation. You know, it's like lucid dreaming. A lucid dream is where you know that you're dreaming. So why don't we just become lucid dreamers and take this dream and turn it into something that we want it to be instead of just having the dream push us around?
Yeah, start to redream the dream, no doubt.
Redream the dream, that's right. And, you know, so psychedelics and shamanism and all the things that have gone on are all part of this thing. And alchemy is the science of the end of time. And that's where we are right now. And I would say we've got about 7 years left, so time for everyone to start considering what that really means.
All right. Well, look, I got one last question, and that is, where are you going to be in 2012?
Well, I'm not going to be in Peru. I'm going to try to be at Giza.
Interesting.
Standing between the paws of the Sphinx, because that's in Fulcanelli's Mystery of the Cathedrals, the very first drawing is of an alchemist standing between the paws of the Sphinx, and underneath it says the Sphinx protects and controls the science. And now, of course, I go into a little bit in the book, but I think that it'll be a very profound place to be at
wow.
the time.
Very interesting. All right, well, look, Jay, we are about at it here, so I think we've done what we set out to do, a wonderful, wonderful explanation of your work over all these years. Thank you very much for sharing it so clearly and articulately with me and with my audience. I really, really appreciate it. It was just wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, you guys, that was it. Jay Widener. And for any of the information on stuff that we were talking about tonight, you can always go down to his website, jaywidener.com. And he will be, of course, on my archives page tomorrow or the next day. I'll have this entire show up on the web, so anybody who wants to download it or listen to it after the fact is welcome to do that. And from the archives page at my site, you can always get over to my guests' links. So that stuff will be there in perpetuity. If you want to go check it out, and I urge you to, because take it for what it's worth, take it for what you will, put it into your combine and mix it up and see what comes out, make your own judgments, but it is profound stuff and really amazing stuff if you look at the connections that it has come from and brought together. In and of itself. So amazing things happening, like Jay says, just an amazing time to be alive, and it's astonishing that we're here in the middle of all this. So look forward to the play as it rolls on. Okay, next week we've got Michael Horn. Michael Horn is sort of the North American representative of Billy Meyer, the classic UFO E.T. story from the hills of Switzerland, and we'll be talking to Michael Horn about Billy Meyer and about what's going on in those worlds these days. And always check us out on the web, www.radioorbit.com. Stick around, the Boogeyman will be back at you in just a few minutes, and we'll close things out the only way we could. This is The Doors, and this is The End. This is Mike Hagen. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN.
This is the end. Beautiful friend. This is the end. My only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end. No safety or surprise. The end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be? So innocent and free. Desperately in need of some stranger's hand. In a desperate land.
The blue bird is calling.